Good afternoon. I want to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We've got two cases on our docket for oral argument and four other cases that will be submitted without oral argument. It's my understanding that everyone has checked in. So if before we begin, I do want to introduce the panel members. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and to my left is Justice Mark Pittman, and I'm Justice Bonnie Sutterth. And will the clerk please call the case? You may begin.
May it please the court. In this case involving a motor vehicle accident, the appellant asks this court to find that there is no subject matter jurisdiction for the plaintiff's lawsuit and to dismiss it. I think that the reason is, and sort of this case in a nutshell, is whether essentially what are the undisputed facts in this case represent an active use of a motor vehicle by an employee of a state agency, or whether they represent a condition of property of that motor vehicle. And that said, I think you can put it a different way. When you sort of do read the briefing in this case, what you see is that Appley is asking this court essentially to abandon the Lillo standard that the Supreme Court set. I say it's a standard. What it is an analysis that sort of helps us to know when a motor vehicle is being operated actively by an employee of the state. And obviously the reason that that's an important thing is because when you look at the Tort Claims Act, when you look at 101021, it says specifically that that there's a waiver for an active for a tort resulting from an active use of a motor vehicle. But once again, the case law and that language is very clear that it's not the same when you're discussing the condition of that vehicle. I think that there and once again, I said the undisputed facts in this case. The facts in this case are not necessarily easily applied to that question. And I think that sort of to frame it, I think a case that's good to look at that's cited in the brief is Sampson versus University of Texas. And once again, Sampson is actually a premises defect case, and so it's a little bit odd because we're talking about the condition of a car, essentially. But I think that it encapsulates the whole sort of Keach versus Kroger issue that's in this case, and that is Keach versus Kroger, right, traditionally sort of stands for this analysis that says that, hey, when you have someone that does a negligent act, like an affirmative negligent act, sometimes that negligent act results in a negligent condition. And so what you have to do is analyze sort of when the injury occurred to determine whether you catch it in the phase where it's the negligent act or whether it's the resulting negligent condition.
Counsel, applying that to the facts of this case, is there a dispute between the two parties as to whether the vehicle was actually in park or not? Do both the parties agree that the vehicle was never actually put in the park position?
Well, first off, Your Honor, I think there's sort of two parts to that answer. With respect to what the parties have agreed to, I think that the appellee has actually sort of changed their position for the appeal. When you look at what their pleading was down at the district court, their pleadings were specifically that the car had been parked, that the driver of the car had left the car, and that the car was unattended at the time. And so in that sense, Your Honor, I think the appellee has already sort of conceded that, yes, the car was parked.
There is a dispute as to whether or not the parking brake was on.
Once again, I don't believe that there's much question. I don't know that there's any evidence as to whether the parking brake was on or not. I don't believe that it was on.
Do you think that matters either way? Does it matter whether it was actually put in park?
Once again, Your Honor, I don't believe so. And the reason.
Tell me why not.
The reason is this. When you have. How should I say this? Whether the parking brake was on was not because you didn't have a driver there who's actively sort of using the parking brake. So you don't have the active use part of it. What you then have is a vehicle that's on an incline, and the argument is, well, you should have put the parking brake on because this vehicle on an incline might roll down the incline. Well, Your Honor, that is a description of the condition of the vehicle. Because once again, there's no dispute that the driver wasn't in it, that the engine wasn't on, he'd closed the door and locked it. So when you talk about that parking brake not having been on, this gets right back to that sort of Keach versus Kroger question.
Well, go ahead. I wonder, though, there's authority from this court back in 1998, the Tarrant County versus English case, and there we held that use and operation of a motor vehicle was involved when you didn't even have any temporal connection at all between diesel fuel being sprayed on the beds of asphalt trucks and the diesel fuel over a period of years leached into the neighboring plaintiff's land. And we held that because those trucks, they were parked and stationary and weren't being used at the time, but because they were being made ready for use, we held that was use and operation of a motor vehicle for purposes of the act.
Well, Your Honor, I think once again that there is some distinction between this case and that case, I believe. And once again, in this case, you don't have this sort of long-term use of the chemical on the machine that leaches into the soil. You have what's a much more straightforward sort of Lilu or Naranjo. Or not Naranjo, actually, but a case essentially involving a driver of the vehicle. And so the allegation is not necessarily that they did something long term, that the use of the vehicle, and presumably the use in that case was the spraying of the chemical.
No. As I recall, the holding in that case was that there was a use of a motor vehicle involved simply because the asphalt trucks were being prepared to go out and be used on the highway, but they weren't doing anything more than being stored
Sure. There.
But let me ask you a slightly different question. Would it matter in this case if, let's say, that the driver of the van had turned the motor off, was still in the van, and let's say it was in neutral accidentally, and it rolled back? I mean, does it matter? You know, what is the critical distinguishing factor? You know, if the driver was in it and it was off, would it be in use? If the driver was out but the motor was on and it rolled back, would that be use?
I think either of those would probably be use under precedent that's across the state.
What if he parked the vehicle but didn't put it in park and just left it in neutral? Left the vehicle and the vehicle wasn't moving at the time, walked down the street, and then it started rolling?
If he had done that, Your Honor, I think that would put it akin to Finnegan versus Blanco County, and that's a case that's actually cited in Naranjo. But in Finnegan, a trooper gets out of the car, leaves the engine running. Someone gets out. Basically, someone escapes and uses his car to then escape. I think that the situations that y'all are describing there are much more akin to that, where you don't have sort of this full and final ending of the use of the vehicle. Because once again, it goes back to also some sort of the school bus cases where you have situations where the car is moving, but then it stops and it's not operating at the point that it's letting kids off, but then it starts up again. What the courts have said consistently is, you know, as long as the engine running, if there's somebody in it, then that vehicle continues to be used until it's brought to a stop. But once again, when you then apply Lilu to that, what Lilu obviously says is, but if you don't have that, if you don't have somebody in it operating it, they didn't leave the engine on, and in this case they did put it in park, locked the door, exited the vehicle.
But they may not have put it in, they may not have engaged the parking brake, and they were on an incline. And anybody who's ever been in San Francisco knows if you're on an incline, you better put your car in a parking brake position because they can roll even if they're in park. You got to set the parking brake. And there's a question as to whether he did that. And that's where, to me, it begins to get very gray.
Well, Your Honor, once again, I understand sort of what you're saying and sort of why that's an issue, because I feel like for any other defendant, that would clearly be negligence. But once again, what you have here is the legislature that said, hey, we're going to draw this distinction between when someone is actively using the vehicle versus when they are no longer actively using.
Of course, the statute doesn't say actively using.
That's correct. But once again, that is a term that has come down from the Supreme Court that has been applied to 021 to distinguish between to demonstrate sort of when waiver occurs under 021.
Well, does it matter in your mind? I mean, the driver, as I remember the facts, the driver had just barely gotten out of the van and hadn't even made it into the building yet when the car, the van starts rolling backwards. I mean, aren't there cases that suggest that if you have something that's either, I think it's geographical or temporal or some other kind of nexus that's not too attenuated, that that can be part of the arises from
I think that that's a reference to the cases that I've already kind of been talking about, where you have somebody who leaves the engine running and the door open or something like that. I mean, I do think that under those circumstances that can be a waiver. But once again, getting back to I think the initial question that you asked me, sort of the difference between the case out of Houston, the case here out of Fort Worth, and this case is essentially you had the intentional acts of those people to use the chemical in that first case, but in this case you had a driver who believe that he put the car in park, and so you don't have like this other act, like he didn't mean to leave the engine on. He didn't mean to leave the door open. He intended to put that thing in park, and as far as he's concerned, he was done driving the vehicle at that point. And so do I believe that there's sort of a temporal requirement? I don't. And I believe, once again, if you look at the case involving the boat in storage, that's Parks and Wildlife versus Lowry. And that's a situation where that clearly the court says, hey, you've got a condition of property here, not a use, because there's nobody there. Now, the court discusses the fact that previously there had been Parks and Wildlife employees at the boat, at the marina, fixing the wires of the boat, like wiring in this new equipment. But once again, specifically, the court does not say that, hey, if they had been doing that wiring, 5 minutes before the fire started, then that would have been a use. But if it's 20 minutes later, then it's not a use.
One of the differences that's been pointed out by the appellee in their brief with regards to the Lowry case was in this case, we don't have a situation where the van was actually parked on state property. Do you believe that makes a difference in our analysis?
I do not believe that makes a difference, Your Honor. And once again, because specifically what Lowry found is that the allegation there was with respect to the condition of property, and the property in question was the boat. The fact that it happened to be at the marina at the time that the fire started, that only sort of showed sort of what the harm was as the result of the fire. But once again, when the court actually analyzed whether the boat was in use at the time, all they analyzed was whether there was an employee present actually using the boat at the time. And when they found that, well, they had left the wires in this condition, but there was no employee there,
we had an employee here who had just seconds before gotten out of the van. So you
had moments before gotten out of the van. That's
okay,
true.
Okay, moments before.
But once again, when you look at the appellee's sort of pleading at the trial court, you'll see that they said, hey, he put it in park. He abandoned the vehicle. He had left it. And so to the extent that in Lowry, there's no analysis of sort of this temporal relationship that moments ago they had been repairing the wire. It's simply not analyzed. And once again, I think that's appropriate here. All you look at is at the time that the harm occurred, that the damage occurred, was there someone, an employee of a state agency, actively using the vehicle? And once again, in this case, at least by the Lee Liu analysis and also by the Naranjo analysis, no, they weren't. And whether they had been using it just a minute ago or 20 minutes ago didn't really enter the analysis. And once again, I'm not sure that, how do you make a rule that says, similar to what I was saying with the boat, if you get out of the car and it rolls, because once again, this rolled because of mechanical failure, the fact that it happened to roll at that spot was sort of a coincidence. What if it had rolled 20 minutes later or 30 minutes later? You end up with a situation where here you're basically eviscerating this rule that says, hey, when the harm happens, the person has to be in the car driving it, or at least have left the motor running or operating it in some way. But once again, in this case, even though it had been only moments before, once again, you had a complete sort of punctuation, an end of that use. Because once again, if you also look at the facts, as he comes running back to the car, he can't get the door open because he's locked the door. Well, that immediately makes it different than the other cases with the school buses or with Flanagan, where you had the engine left running and the door left open. Because once again, you have facts in this case that demonstrate that there was a clear end to the use of the vehicle. And at the point that the use of the vehicle ended, if that use resulted in a dangerous condition, that dangerous condition went on to harm PHI's helicopter, That's fine, but that's what it is. Once again, once that use ended, you entered the situation where now you had the dangerous condition, and it's the dangerous condition that caused the harm in this case, not the active use. And so, you know, once again, that it gets right back to the sort of Keach versus Kroger, which is where you have someone that takes an affirmative act. That affirmative act might be negligent. I'm not sure that the affirmative act is negligent in this case because, once again, there's no evidence that Mr. Webb, the driver, actually knew that the shifter was going to fail the way it did. But just assuming for the moment or for arguendo that is the case, you still have this timeline where you have the active use of it and then you have the condition that results. And once again, under the Tort Claims Act, if you're using the motor vehicle and you're in that part of the timeline where there's active use, then there's waiver. But if you're in the part of the timeline where there's just a condition that resulted from that affirmative act, then there is no waiver. And that said, Your Honors, we would ask that you find, consistent with Lee Liu, find that there was no active use on behalf of on the part of the driver. The driver had turned off the engine, gotten out of the car, locked the door, closed the door. He had gone on about his business. There was a mechanical failure that there's no indication that he was aware of. And as a result, we would ask that you find that there's no waiver of sovereign immunity and that you dismiss the plaintiff's case. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Steve Sanfilippo for Appley PHI Inc. I'd like to start by saying PHI does not in fact concede the fact that the vehicle was in park, and in fact I would point the court to two pieces of evidence tending to indicate or at least giving a reasonable inference to the fact that the vehicle was not put into park. In the clerk's record, page 47, there's a PHI incident form filled out by PHI crew member Ryan Aust, who stated that after the vehicle had rolled into the helicopter, he attempted to secure it so it couldn't roll any further, and he could not get the vehicle in park. So he applied the emergency brake. This gives you the inference of two different things. One, the vehicle wasn't in park, and two, the emergency brake wasn't on. That second thing, the emergency brake, we pled that the emergency brake was not engaged at the time, and that has not been negated by any evidence put forth by the Juvenile Justice Department. The second piece of evidence would be the outside service provider's invoice, which said that the vehicle was in such disrepair that, in fact, it was incapable of being put into park at the time that the vehicle was attempted to be parked. So while we pled, I think the court has to look at the allegations in the totality of the pleading. And while we have pled that he parked the vehicle, what we pled was he parked the vehicle in it, but it wasn't parked. It rolled down into the helicopter. It rolled precisely because it was not, in fact, actually put in the park.
But would that be, as the appellant suggests, more a complaint about the condition of the vehicle rather than its being used at that point?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The standard is whether or not the property damage arises from the use. It doesn't require active use at the absolute point of impact. All it requires is that it arises out of the use. And I would point this court to two sister court of appeals opinions, both cited in the brief, one from Austin, one from the San Antonio Court of Appeals, both of which say that the act of actually stopping a vehicle is part and parcel of use and operation of a vehicle. And I would submit to the court that it would be a bad precedent to set that this issue turns on whether or not someone has turned the key off and gotten out of the vehicle before he put it in park, or whether he was still sitting behind the wheel and it started to roll. And in fact, there's evidence in the record that the key, and this is in the clerk's record at page 71, the key was capable of being removed from this vehicle while the engine was there, the transmission was still engaged. So the fact that he was able to pull the key out and lock the vehicle does not, on this record, give rise to a conclusive evidence that he had placed this vehicle in park and got out of the vehicle. And again, I would just submit to the court that on this record, you know, the key facts are undisputed. We would submit that you don't even get to most of what they raise in their brief, because you have no question you have property damage. You have no question that you have employees in the course and scope of their employment using and operating a motor vehicle, and we would just submit to the court that actually putting the vehicle in park and securing it before it rolls is a necessary part of the transportation process. In the Lulu case, the court found that that transportation process is what this statute is geared toward, and in fact, in that case, it found that the active loading and unloading of students from a bus after the bus obviously had stopped is part of the transportation process and could theoretically give rise to a claim of waiver of immunity. We would submit to the court that if the loading and unloading of someone off a stopped bus is part of the transportation process that could be subject to immunity, certainly having to stop the vehicle, put the vehicle in park, and secure it from rolling is an even more direct operation, part of the transportational process.
Counsel, is there a distinction to be drawn from the fact that the injury to the helicopter had nothing to do with the vans being used to transport somebody to the hospital and unloading them? I mean, is that a fact that sort of breaks the causality?
I don't think so. All the property damage has to do is arise out of. Does this arise out of their use? I don't think it has to be part of the narrow sequence of events. You know, I don't think the distinction turns on whether he ran into the helicopter on the way to the front door as opposed to having parked the vehicle and it rolled down into the helicopter, at least under the case law, Your Honor. I don't think that that's a distinction on which the outcome of this case turns.
Would it make a difference to your analysis, do you think, if the van had been parked for a day before it started rolling?
Yeah, if it made a difference in the analysis, I think it would be to the effect of you'd have to look at what would have something other than this vehicle not being properly placed in park would have caused it to roll after a full day down an incline. I think the temporal part of the issue is important here.
Well, would 2 hours make a difference?
Possibly.
What about this question, counsel? What if we send this back to the trial court? You all conduct discovery and get experts, and it looks pretty clear that the vehicle was put in park. At that point, would you concede that there's no jurisdiction under the Tort Claims Act?
Absolutely not, because whether or not, the evidence that it was incapable of actually being put in park is undisputed. It's from their outside service provider. Second, even if the vehicle itself was put in park, it has not been negated at this point, and I don't think is capable of being negated, that the emergency brake was not applied. And I would point the court to the peace officer's report, which is in the record at, I have my record citations here. It is in the record at record 51, which found that a contributing factor in the accident is that the vehicle was parked and that the driver failed to set the parking brake. A second contributing factor, driver inattention. I don't think it would make a difference to us whether somebody did come forward and say this thing was in park. The most they could ever do is to say the little notch looked like it was on the P, because we know it wasn't in park or it wouldn't have rolled. So with that, unless the court has any questions, our position is, any way you slice this, parking a vehicle and securing it from rolling is absolutely a part of the process of operating and using a vehicle. The undisputed or at least uncontroverted allegations in this case are that they did not secure the vehicle from rolling, did not apply the parking brake, and we believe that is enough under the statute to give rise to waiver of immunity. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
By way of rebuttal, there are a couple of things. First, I'd like to start off with the evidence as to whether the car was actually placed in park, because I think that once again, counsel has said something that I think is very interesting, which is the shifter could have been in P such that the person driving it would have thought that the car was in park, and there was a mechanical failure that caused that to not be the case. Now, I think that's important for a couple of reasons. First, it gets back to whether the driver intentionally did something that created this condition. I'm not sure that that gets them there, but I think that the fact that the driver does something intentional that results in that would get them closer to the area of law that might get them there, right? But here's the problem with that. First off, the report of the employee only is a reflection of what the state of that shifter was after the incident happened. Right, and if you look, there's a lot of other evidence about what the state of that shifter was after the incident happened, because there's the report of the employee, Mr. Webb, the affidavit of his supervisor, Paul Bartouche, who said specifically that he looked to see if the car was placed in park, and what he could see on the dashboard was that the little notch was over the P. Right, and once again, if you look at that same crash report cited, the officer indicates that the car had been placed in park. And so there is quite a bit of evidence that prior to this incident occurring, this was placed in park. And
well, but what about the, as counsel was just citing to, I think it was at 251, the report that ascribed as a contributing factor to this incident the lack of the parking brake, the emergency brake having been put on?
And once again, Your Honor, like I said, I know that sets off everybody's radar, and once again, I have to concede that for any other defendant, I think that would be enough negligence for the case to survive. But once again, I think what's important here is that because we're talking about a specific legislative waiver that is meant to be read narrowly, that's why you have to look at whether or not that situation described where someone parks a car on an incline and doesn't put the parking brake on, you know, if he had been in the car and that car had rolled into the helicopter when he did that, he was in it, or he hadn't turned the engine off and it happened, they would be there. But the fact of the matter is that there's no question that he had gotten out. That, you know, that what that they're talking about insofar as the van being on the incline without the parking brake on, that was a condition of the van, not the result of the active use of the van. It's sort of the aftermath of the active use of the van. There's no question about that.
Well, isn't part of the use of a motor vehicle the act of parking it securely?
Well, and once again, I'd like to also, yeah, and that, I'm glad that you asked that, because one of the cases that counsel cites is this Naranjo case, and he cites that Naranjo case for this premise that part of the act of using a vehicle is stopping and starting the vehicle. Well, I'd ask you to take look at that case closely, because Naranjo doesn't involve a moving vehicle. Naranjo involves a vehicle that injured students while they were in a shop class, because the kid was putting gas in the carburetor and somebody cranked the engine, and that's how the injury occurred. So, once again, when you actually get down to like sort of where that principle comes from, that stopping the car is part of the use of it, that comes from cases, the school bus cases, where you have basically a vehicle that stops and starts and stops and starts and stops and starts. And so in the periods when it's stopped and they're letting kids off, that's the active letting kids on and off of the bus. I mean, that's where the negligence remains, where the active use of the vehicle remains all throughout the course of that activity. But once again, that's different than this activity, because there's no question that at the point that he parked the van, he was done letting the kid off and letting the other employee off. He was just parking the van. And once he had parked it, he closed it, he locked the door, he was done using the van. And at the point that he was done operating that van, you entered the period where we're talking about the condition of the van. Now, the condition of the van, you know, once again, under another circumstance, might result in negligence. But once again, in this case, where you have so much case law that says, you know, when you have this waiver of sovereign immunity under 021 that's related to a motor vehicle, it has to be active use. And once again, you have Leilu and in Naranjo both. In Naranjo, they look and they say specifically, they say, was, you know, and this is, once again, where the kid got injured, the shop class. What the San Antonio court specifically says is, was he transporting students? Nope. Was he driving the car? Nope. Did he leave the engine running? Nope. And they said that because those three things are true, they were not actively putting the vehicle into use. And once again, just like with Leilu, when you apply that same set of factors to the case at bar, we were done transporting the individual to the hospital. He wasn't driving the car, and he didn't leave the engine running.
Okay, so for your proposition that at some point a negligent act becomes a negligent condition, and in this case it became a negligent condition, what is your best case that says that?
The best case, I believe, is Parks and Wildlife versus Lowry. Okay. Once again, that's the boat case out of the Supreme Court. Once again, and that's a case where they discuss the fact that there were employees there, but there is no discussion about the temporal relationship of when they were there. The only question was that they weren't there when the boat caught on fire. That's, I think, very analogous to the case at Barr.
Thank you. Any other questions?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you so much. Gentlemen, your case has been submitted.